Hello, I am Joel McLeod.
And I'm Roland Tanner.
And welcome to the 905er. One of the very first episodes we ever did with this podcast was to examine the aftermath of Doug Ford's first broken promise, the cancellation of the Basic Income Pilot Project. For Ontarians in Lindsay, Thunder Bay, and Hamilton, who were living at or below the poverty line, it was a very simple social experiment. Guarantee a sum of money for the recipients to receive with no conditions or strings attached, bringing them up to the poverty line and see how it would affect their lives. The plan was for the project to work with a select group of people for 3 years. After this time, the data would be collected and measurements taken to see if it improved the lives of those involved. Upon completion, the Ontario government could use the experiment to extrapolate what a provincial-wide program would entail. Halfway through the experiment, the provincial government changed, and Doug Ford was elected on a promise that he would not touch the program and let it run its course. Instead, he asked his then-minister, Lisa McLeod, no relation, to cancel the program without warning, leaving many of the participants in the lurch. Since then, the participants have stated that they have lost footing socially and economically. Plans to start businesses or to go back to school have been cancelled due to the loss of income. Many have stated that this sudden end to the program uprooted their lives over a broken contract. As such, a class action lawsuit has been filed on behalf of the participants in Ontario court. They are seeking a sum of $200 million along with added costs. Back when we did an episode on the basic income guarantee, we spoke with one of those participants, Jesse Golem of Hamilton. Jesse was an artist struggling to make ends meet and stated that the program helped her find the ability to begin a business, but with its cancellation, she has fallen back into the poverty cycle. She is also one of the most vocal advocates for a basic income guarantee and is involved in the court action. Alongside her is Stephen Moreau of Cavaluzzo LLP, who is the lead counsel representing the plaintiffs in this class action lawsuit. Both of them join us today to discuss the case and why they believe the Doug Ford government needs to pay for its broken promises. Okay, well, thank you to Stephen Moreau and Jesse Golem for coming on to the 905er today for this episode to discuss this very important topic. Jesse, we had you on. You're one of our very first guests on the podcast way back in the day. We're going to have a link in the show notes to for our listeners to catch up with that episode. But
I remember that.
I'll put it to you and say, this is a very dramatic kind of turn in the story of taking the government to court over the cancellation of that UBI project. I'm going to throw it open to you and say, how did you come to this point in this journey so far?
It's actually been a long time coming. So it does feel dramatic right now just because the class action got certified, but we've been putting forward a class action lawsuit almost like since the cancellation. So the class action was actually first brought forward by a lawyer in Lindsay named Mike Perry. And he put it forward, but then it wasn't certified back in like 2019 or 2018 or 2019 when that went forward. So then Stephen Moreau and the people at Cavaluzzo. Sorry about that. I don't know.
That's
what
okay.
Happened. I was just talking and then it vanished. But anyway, so I was saying it didn't get certified then. So then the Stephen Moreau and Cavaluzzo LLP took it up and then they appealed the decision. And it took this long, I imagine, because of the pandemic and mm-hmm. other mitigating factors for them to reverse the decision and say, yes, this can be certified as a class action. So that only happened in March. So that's sort of why all of a sudden things are moving very fast. But I've been waiting for this day for years. So
could you maybe just go into a bit more detail into what exactly is the class action entailing? And I'll invite Stephen to jump in on this as he might have more of the technical side of it. But are you filing here, just so our listeners are aware?
There are four plaintiffs. I'm not one of them, actually. They all live in Lindsay, that are suing the government on behalf of all the recipients of the basic income pilot for $200 million for damages for the premature cancellation of the pilot. Correct me if I'm wrong, Stephen. Is that's somewhat accurate?
I mean, more that number has been bandied about, and it's true that the number 200 million appears in the claim. But what they're actually claiming, in addition to $200 million, is the damages for the cancellation itself. And there's a direct set of damages for the cancellation in the form of the unpaid payments from the basic income plan. But also, there's this large global number to make sure we capture any additional damages individuals might have suffered due to the premature cancellation. So, for example, if somebody was hospitalized, that they might enjoy a substantial amount of damages at the end of this, and that might go towards the 200 million.
And I guess the question I think a lot of people have on their minds about this is, well, I understand it was very disruptive to you, Jesse, and to the other recipients of the program. But the Ford government, prior to being elected, had said they were not going to cancel the program. And then once they got elected, I believe it was one of the first actions that they took in office. Now, critics are going to say, well, that's tough. That's democracy. We elect governments to change course and change direction constantly. That's what happened here. We elected a new government. They said, nope, we're going to cancel this program. Tough. Go get a job, is what critics are now shouting into the microphone or into their speakers as they're listening to this. And I'm saying, why are you going to take the government to court for basically doing what we elect governments to do, which is just change direction of policy and procedure?
Well, even though there is a change in policy and procedure, like we, the people who were on the pilot signed a contract and entered into an agreement. And that contract very clearly stated that this pilot would last for 3 years. So we made plans based on those 3 years. I made plans based on those 3 years and changed my life around based on that promise. And yes, it was a broken promise, but it's also like the reneging of a contract. Like they did not uphold their end of the agreement. Like we gave them personal information, like my tax information, my banking information, my proof of income, like things that I just don't share with anybody. And then in exchange as well, like I was giving them 3 years of my data to be used in research. So in exchange for for being on the basic income pilot, so they didn't uphold their end of the agreement. That's what it straight up is. It doesn't matter what government it is, the agreement still existed b beforehand. And things can't just get canceled whenever because a new government comes in. That doesn't make sense. Like that's not how governments and society work. Also, for those people just saying, "Well, get a job and suck it up." I've had a job this entire time. I have never not worked, being on the basic income pilot and off of it. So when people say that, I was just kind of like, "Bud," but anyway.
I mean,
Yeah,
let me add
man.
to that. Let me add to that. That I mean, a government, of course, has a right to change. Well, first of all, the population has the right to change governments, and the governments of the day have the right to change policy. But governments are still legally, when they enter into contracts, they're required to fulfill the terms of the contract, and that doesn't change even if the government changes hands once, twice, three, or four times, or even if the government changes policy. The contract itself continues in full force and effect. You can imagine that. If, for example, a government of the day wanted to build a really large structure, I don't know, like the big subway here in Toronto, they're not going to get anybody to sign an agreement with government unless the agreement lasts for a long period of time with a whole series of guarantees. And so you wouldn't be able to do business in this province if contracts could just simply vanish into thin air just because a new government or new policy comes into being. This is an age-old, settled, tried and true sort of principle. So again, government can change hands, government can change policy, government can't change contracts, though.
And I guess the classic example of that in Ontario actually is it's the 407, Highway 407, isn't it? That the when the Liberals came in after the previous PC government, they were like, right, we're going to get rid of all these tolls, but the contract is signed, and that's that. That's the and yeah.
I mean, when governments take over and decide, well, let's start breaching contracts or reneging on contracts or so on, they start to lose credibility in the business world. They can even see their credit rating drop, and big slogans like open for business or good for business start to ring hollow. So this is why governments are very careful not to renege on their contracts, even if they're new.
So I mean, Stephen, you obviously think as the lead lead counsel in this case that you've got a strong case. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. But I mean, is it as straightforward as you say it is? I mean, is this kind of a straightforward case of breach of contract? I mean, and does this fit into a pattern with this government where they've had a number of prominent cases recently, thinking of the other major one being with the teachers unions, where they, you know, were trying to implement a pay settlement and lost and have now had to pay all that money back. I mean, is this part of a pattern of the government just being kind of amateurs when it comes to basic legal principles?
Well, I mean, they are either amateurs when it comes to basic legal principles, or they do have a plan. I mean, a contracting party also does have the right to breach the contract and then pay the appropriate price, which I suppose is what we're alleging in the class action, is that, you know, Ontario in theory could shut down the basic income pilot as long as they pay lots and lots of money to do so. Otherwise, I mean, yes, Ontario has lost a number of court challenges. Many of them are non-contract based, so they've lost large constitutional claims. They did lose. They did take over a lawsuit that they lost against the Horse Breeders Association, and that was in breach of contract. And it's very similar to our case. So, overall, and more generally, in answer to your initial part of your question, I mean, we do think we have a strong case. I mean, these documents that people like Jesse signed are very long, they're very thoroughgoing, they're very clear in terms of the conditions that were accepted, and Ontario was quite clear about the fact that they were guaranteeing these 3 years of payments. I mean, the whole issue, or the whole nature of a basic income, is that you have to guarantee to people a certain level of income for a certain period of time. Just simply throwing money arbitrarily at somebody, even more money, with strings attached, in the sense of, well, we can take it away whenever we feel like it. The individual receiving those monies is not going to alter their behavior in the way that Jesse described earlier. So, in our opinion, it is a very strong claim.
I'm curious to know. I know Jesse, you said that there were four people in Peterborough that are on the actual lawsuit that was filing. But since it's a class action, presumably for all participants, because I believe it was not just Hamilton, Peterborough, but I believe also Thunder Bay.
That's correct.
Included in that jurisdiction as well. How many people in total would be involved in this class action if you're to win, and presumably all these people are now able to gain some kind of restitution for that lost year, I believe. How many people are we talking about generally?
I don't know like the exact down to the exact person number, but it is in the range of 4,000 people. And the reason I don't know the exact number is because people have died since the cancellation.
Okay. So let's go with 4,000 for the sake of this discussion.
Yeah.
So 4,000 people back in the last government signed on to this project to see how it impact their lives for the better or worse and see through. A follow-up question to that then is, and this is to you, Stephen, the data that was collected from these people during this project, at any point are we going to find out what happened to that data? Like, would you be inclined to have that data be released to these individuals so that maybe there are professors or sociologists who would want to examine what happened during this experiment?
I mean, that's a tough question to answer because I don't really know the answer, but I think I can help with a couple of details around that question. There was an initial survey that individuals took when they joined the basic income pilot. There were 4,001 who joined who were receiving payments. And then there were others who joined who were not receiving payments. So I think it's roughly about 6,000 total between the two groups. they would have taken an initial survey. So like a kind of the before picture survey as part of the condition to join. That data would be stored somewhere. It would be available somewhere. It would be interesting to look at it. I don't believe it's been released, as you put it. I don't think it can be released without some kind of order or some kind of agreement to do so. That would be interesting data, but sadly, it's not data as to how the pilot was working or would have worked. It's data as to how people were situated before they started the pilot. So I don't know to what extent professors would find that interesting. It would be better than nothing, but it wouldn't tell you anything about how a pilot works or how basic income works.
I can kind of speak to it. So because like the moment that the pilot was canceled, the data was damaged irrevocably. Like it's not accurate anymore because of the cancellation. So there was that initial survey that we all took. And yes, there were two groups. There were the people receiving basic income and a control group. It was random lottery. That was how I was told that the selection process went. So from everybody who signed up, you could end up either way. When that happened, they actually the government fired the researchers, and were basically planning to shelf the data and not put it in the public eye ever. But then what happened was that the Basic Income Canada Network and, I believe McMaster University, I could be wrong, or McGill, I'm not sure which university it was. They continued the research. So knowing that the data was damaged, they still conducted surveys on the people who were on the pilot, asking them like what life was like and everything, to just try and get some sort of picture of the effects of the basic income pilot, positive or negative. And that stuff was compiled into a report called Signposts for Success. So if you Google like Basic Income Canada Network Signposts for Success, you'll find the report on that and what sort of data they were able to gain.
And Jesse, I mean, just to remind our listeners who may not have heard the episode we did with you before, perhaps you could just speak about your experience as being part of the pilot, how you came to be in it, and the effects that you felt it was having at the time it was cancelled, and perhaps, you know, what's happened since.
Yeah. So like before I was on the pilot, I had four jobs. Like I was very much struggling to get to cobble together jobs. And most of these jobs are gig work and contract work. I'm a full-time artist. I'm a musician. I'm a photographer. People might say that those jobs don't deserve to be paid. And to those people, I say never listen to music ever again and never look at art ever again. And let me know how your life is going. But anyway, I was also like recovering from a financially abusive relationship that had drained my savings and tanked my credit, and just trying to build back my life again. So going on the pilot, I remember I got that letter and it took me a full day for it to sink in because I was so busy working. And at the end of the day, it sort of occurred to me that my rent was going to be covered. And I like the relief I felt was palpable. And I was using basic income to start a business. So I was able to like drop down from having multiple jobs and just focus my time and my energy into building a business I had been dreaming about for a very long time and not really finding that I had the time or the energy to invest into it. But now I had that time and energy because I had the assurance that my rent would be covered. I was working the entire time I was on the basic income pilot. So you received, if you were a single person, you could receive up to $1,200 a month. But if you were working, that amount would be subtracted by 50 cents to the dollar. So I received about $700 a month. So it covered my rent. It didn't cover much of anything else. Like it didn't pay for my car or my phone bill or my food or anything like that. It really motivated me. And I was seeing my business grow. And it was growing pretty exponentially. And I was able to predict, like I wrote a business plan. I did a year of financial forecasting. And I predicted that I would only have been on the pilot for 2 out of the 3 years it was supposed to run, because at that point, I would have been making too much money. I wouldn't have been eligible to be on the pilot. So the cancellation, I have never been that angry in my entire life. Like I was absolutely furious. And my reaction was that I wanted people and I wanted the government to know who this was affecting. and I wanted them to know our names. So I started finding the other basic income recipients, and I asked them to, in their own words, tell me their stories and what they were using basic income for. And they would write it down on cardboard, and I would take their pictures. And that created a portrait series called Humans of Basic Income. And you know, it's weird looking back on it because it's been about 6 years, but that is sort of the source of the qualitative data and the stories of the individuals that were on this pilot, and sort of humanizes this from, like, you know, 4,000 people receiving X amount of dollars per month to these people have faces and names and wishes, hopes and dreams and kids and families and friends, and they could be your neighbor. And that sort of shifts the story a little bit and makes us realize, like, the impact that these government decisions have on people. On all of us. So that's like the portrait series and the subsequent advocacy work that I do has changed my life, but in a good way. But like, if the pilot, I do honestly wish, I have looked back and thought, like, you know, my life is going in this direction, but I do wish the pilot had never been canceled. And that I was able to build my business and, you know, not live in poverty anymore and be able to contribute to the economy and pay taxes and hire staff and, you know, do the thing I've always wanted to do. So, it's been an interesting journey, but that sort of is where it has gone. And those portraits have been all over the world at this point.
Well, and I suppose it really speaks to the key point of a cancellation of a contract that you had the rug pulled out from underneath you. You had planned, you had like you'd done business plans. You had thought out carefully about how you could use the basic income to build a future for yourself, and that was taken away. And as Steve said, you can say that the government has the right to do those things, but it doesn't have the right to promise one thing in a contract and change its mind. So I think it's a really interesting perspective on it that's being taken. Sorry, just lost my train of thought there for a second, as happens on Saturday mornings. What's Stephen, coming back to you for a moment, I mean, what's the likely timeline on this kind of case? I mean, we tend to hear of class action suits, certainly in the US anyway, taking years and years and years to solve. Is that the kind of thing that we're looking at here?
Well, Jesse started down the path of explaining what happened here. I mean, it was officially started in late 2018 and then turned into the formal claim in March of 2019. It took 5 years for the
Just
claim to
okay.
be certified.
Right.
Certified is permission for the four plaintiffs to act for the 4,001 affected class members. So it doesn't sound like much. I mean, it's permission to act, but it is a very hotly contested, hotly fought over, detailed motion. And so 5 years is on the extreme end, in part because there was an appeal that we had to launch in order to get things going. So 5 years to get here. All I can say is years to get to the next stage, which would be the trial. I mean, to get to trial, we have to examine the Ontario government witnesses. We have to examine their documents. That just takes time. I can't
And
say more than that.
the discovery process is always particularly interesting because the government will be obliged, I take it, to hand over documents that they'd probably quite likely rather not hand over in an ideal world. I mean, not suggesting anything inappropriate, but just
No,
they would.
I wouldn't suggest anything inappropriate either. But what was interesting in this case, it's a little interesting sidelight, but it tells you what we're dealing with here. In order to really better understand what was going on, I mean, we didn't just launch this lawsuit just for fun and throw some dice and hope it lands on snake eyes. I mean, we examined literally thousands of pages of documents, but we also did ask early on. Of government through an access request, an access information request, or freedom of information request, that they send over a documentation. And they sent some, and we weren't sure that we had them all, but we were told we had them all. And then we launched the lawsuit or kept the lawsuit going with the materials we had. And then we went through this whole certification motion and appeal process. And then we came back down to finish certification. And in late 2022, this would be 3.5, almost 4 years after our freedom of information request was answered. The government lawyers said, "Whoops, sorry, we just discovered a whole bunch of other documents we forgot to send you, which may or may not have been responsive, but frankly, were responsive to our freedom request. And we were talking about thousands of pages, and there's some very interesting materials in those thousands of pages, very interesting materials indeed that are relevant to some of the basic issues that we're, or basic arguments that we are making. So you can imagine that we are going to want a discovery process to get everything when clearly we weren't given everything, even as early as 2019, notwithstanding our right to get it and the fact that we asked for it.
And I just want to come back one final time, Jesse. I mean, the again, for anybody not familiar with how the basic income kind of works, and the impression you could easily receive from just reading articles on how this is reported in, for instance, picking at random, globalnews.ca, the quotes from Lisa McLeod when it was cancelled back in 2018, like this is a disincentive to get people back on track. We're giving people money with no strings attached. Doesn't send the right message. Is that in any way a fair reflection of how the basic income works? I mean, was it just like they sent you this big check? And as my understanding is, the biggest possible check you could receive would be $17,000 a year, which where I live is not something that's actually gonna pay your rent. No, that's not hardly a ticket to a comfortable lifestyle.
No.
So perhaps you could just speak to that again. Those the traditional reasons for opposing a basic income are that we're just giving money to people who are lazy, sitting around on their backsides doing nothing, basically to do all the cliches at once.
Well, like empirically speaking, and like evidence-based speaking, like removing any feelings or facts about it, because like those opinions are based on feelings and assumptions about people. Empirically speaking, that's simply not accurate. People have done studies asking those exact questions: does a basic income disincentivize or incentivize work? And they have looked at like there are actual studies. There was I believe it's in California, I forget his name, but there was a study that was conducted that looked at pilot projects, basic income pilots that have taken place all over the world over the last 50 years, which is the hugest control group. Like we're talking about different countries, different groups of people, different amounts of money for different periods of time, over a span of decades, and asking, like, when all these people received basic income, did they work less or more? And the answer is, like, very broadly across the board, that people worked more. The only groups of people that worked less were people that chose to be stay-at-home parents or caregivers to like elderly or disabled family or friends, or people that chose to go back to school. So nobody was actually working less. You think about like the worth and the value, and like trying to quantify the value of like a stay-at-home parent or a caregiver, or people who are going back to school to get a better education so that they can get a better job in return. I'm certain that there are people that, sit around playing video games all day, but like you're saying, the amount is so small that all you could really afford to do is probably live in your parents' basement and eat ramen, and that would be your life. But if you use that amount wisely, then it's an investment. And that the those that the amount of people that do that, like sit in their basement, is such a small, negligible amount compared to the amount of people that don't do that, who are building businesses like myself, who are moving into better housing, getting themselves out of poverty, investing in their lives and in their families in good ways. And that's honestly what I saw when I began my portrait series and traveled all over Ontario to find all these people and talk to them and learn their stories. Nobody was working less. People were there, a lot of care was being put into their families, a lot of ambitions, a lot of hopes, and a lot of dreams. And to see those all ripped away was a level of devastating that I have never experienced before. And probably I don't know when or how I will ever experience that again. And I don't want to.
And ultimately, I guess it was a pilot, wasn't it? And the point of a pilot is just to find out
Yeah.
whether the accusations that the government made are true or not. And only by having the pilot can you establish that. So
Exactly. Like,
it's even if you're of a conservative perspective, there's no
yeah.
reason why conservatives should be anti-evidence, and evidence gathering was the point of the pilot. So yeah.
Yeah, like another thing I wanted to say on to that is that, like, regardless of whether you are for this pilot or against this pilot, you want to see it through to the end, because even if you're against it, you can say, hey, see, this doesn't work.
We
Like,
told
this
you
is why
so.
it doesn't. Well, you got the data. And then the other thing I always challenge people on is, when they say, I don't want, these lazy freeloaders taking my taxpayer money, I'm like, you're assuming the worst in human beings, because you're assuming that humans, if left up to their own devices, are going to be these depraved, morally corrupt creatures that are just going to lie and cheat and steal and take away your hard-earned taxpayers' money. What does that say about you and your character? And also, like, why would you assume the worst in people? I would rather assume the best in people. I don't want to pay $80 billion in taxpayer money per year to fund poverty, because that is literally how much it costs in our country for poverty. I would rather that money go into investing in the well-being of people to see what they do if they have those abilities, like what sorts of businesses they'll start, what sorts of educational opportunities will they pursue, what sorts of lives are they going to build, and that betters all of us as a society. I would rather do that, and then instead of assume the worst. And when people say that, I kind of can't help but look at them and say, what is wrong with you? Like, are you a psychopath? Like, why would you think this about humans?
I was just going to say, I think
I'm less and less sympathetic by the day.
we're coming up a bit on our time, and I just wanted to close off with my half of this conversation with now that the you filed this class action lawsuit, it's certified and moving forward. Have you heard back from the what's the response been from the government so far with have they reached out, or have they said anything officially, or any made any statements on this lawsuit, or are they keeping their lips sealed, as so to speak?
Well, that's a delicate question, calls for a delicate answer. Anything they say to me privately, I can't share.
I'm not
So,
looking for it for anything of that nature. I'm more curious to know if you've had any public statements made towards you or about this the situation.
the only public statements that I can refer you to are what government says in the courts, because that's where they are fighting this lawsuit. And I would say even rightfully so. I don't mind telling you my point of view on various aspects and answering your questions. Government doesn't tend to answer questions about ongoing lawsuits. So to answer your question, what has government said publicly? What they've said is what they've said in their court documents. And what they said in their court documents has enabled them to lose time and time again. And so through whatever they're saying in their court documents, they're finding themselves now 5 years later with having lost an appeal, lost a motion they brought to reschedule the certification motion that failed, and now they've lost certification itself. And as you may have read in the news recently, they have paid $320,000 in what is known as costs to opposing counsel. That's me and my firm for the time and trouble and expense of defending this, or not defending, but of winning this motion. Ontario could have early on come to the table and resolved the motion, but instead they chose to fight it, and now they have to pay for it. So that I think that tells you how Ontario is publicly responding to the claim and the terrific results that they're achieving for themselves, which is irony. They're not by doing so.
So if the government just kind of, I guess the question, in the interest of saving taxpayers' money in fighting this class action lawsuit going forward, there'd be a way to negotiate this to a settlement that would just save time, money, effort, legal fees, all of that, and just kind of close this chapter and move on, wouldn't there? Instead of fighting this.
We are calling on government to do the right thing, to sit down and come to a fair and reasonable resolution. The class doesn't need every single dollar that they're owed. They can negotiate fairly and reasonably to try and get a fair and reasonable outcome. I'm saying fair and reasonable often, but that is what we're looking for. It takes two to tango, and government can make decisions on these things. They can decide to settle early and now, fairly and reasonably, or they can decide to keep fighting, and we've seen what the results are so far by taking the fighting approach.
Why do you think the government is looking to fight you on this? I remember back when the government first took power, you weren't the only contract that they ended. They ended the the Green Energy Act, and in that process canceled a number of wind turbine projects around the province. And there was a big, there was industry saying we want our cancellation fees, and I believe they settled that out of court. Why do you think that they're fighting you on this so much, rather than just saying, okay, let's find a settlement and put this behind us and move on?
I genuinely don't know. I don't advise government. I'm not an elected official. It's a good question to ask them. I genuinely don't know the answer to that.
I know we're coming to the end of our time, but just one question which just come into my mind recently with in regard to a number of these court cases. Since I've got a lawyer on the phone, I may be able to answer. is there an element with fighting these cases that by delaying and delaying and delaying, the government is somehow making this cheaper for themselves, that in terms of government debt or just throwing this down the road so it's another government's problem to worry about, perhaps, that it's worth treating people badly even when they know they're likely to lose a case? Or is that just my kind of paranoid delusions clicking into effect?
I don't know if they know they will lose. I don't know to what extent they think they will lose, what percentage they've put on it. So I can't really speak to that. It's not uncommon for a defendant generally in a court, be it a government or otherwise, to think that if they fight it for a while, that the plaintiff will either go away or will succumb and want to resolve things for less. That's a common strategy. It can be an unfortunate strategy sometimes. It can be a good strategy depending on whose side of the table you're on. So that's my best speculation as to what they're doing and why. But again, you'd have to ask them as to what their thinking is around this.
Well, we would love to have the government on sometime to speak to us about subjects like this and many others. But thus far, we have they haven't been rushing to the microphone to speak to us. But they are invited and welcome as they have been for the last 4 years and more.
I can assure you that every media outlet and non-media outlet that has attempted to reach them has received the same warm response.
We're certainly nothing special.
Well, I think on that note, though, we are coming up on our time, and it is a Saturday morning that we are recording this, and I think it's time for us to call it a quits and let us go and enjoy the weekend, so to speak. But thank you to Stephen and Jesse for coming on to share your perspective and the path that you both have taken to get here, and we'll keep an eye on this and see how it progresses. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us. It's great to see you again.
Likewise.
Thanks. Yeah. Thank nice you. To meet you both. Take care.
Thank you. And you. Thanks.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of the 905er. Thank you for listening. As always, you can send us your feedback, thoughts, and concerns, or ideas for future episodes to our email, info@905er.ca. We'd love to hear from you. You can help us keep the 905er going by financially supporting us through Patreon as well as PayPal. Visit us at 905er.ca and click on the support tab. As well, links are in the show notes for your convenience. Lastly, you can find us on social media. Search for the_905er on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. So long for now. See you next time.
To make the most out of this life and optimize your personal wellness? Then check out the Natural Man Podcast. Join me, host Mike C., as we explore all areas of human wellness, physical, mental, and emotional. Learn strategies to optimize your own well-being and be in the driver's seat of your own health. Remember, your doctor works for you. Learn biohacks, neurohacks, ways to improve sleep, and ways to optimize your body and your mind. Check us out on Apple, Spotify, the Fountain app, and at naturalmanpodcast.com.